I wanted to get the goat meat seared before I put the spices in. It locks the juices inside the meat to get it sealed on the outside, and so it'll maybe be a little tender.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Food and drink are defining cultural features. Philly has its cheesesteak, Chicago has its pizza, Manhattan has its cocktail. But what flavors define the West? This month, we're going to meet people who are putting their mark on the culinary world from right here in Wyoming. Let's start with a little caffeine boost. H&S Coffee is trying to change the definition of cowboy coffee from strong and bitter to smooth and flavorful. Wyoming Public Radio's Miles Bryan stopped by the roastery to sample a few brews.
Okay, this is public radio, so there's a decent chance you're listening to this story in your kitchen or in your car while sipping a cup of coffee. Well, here's your first coffee tip. Those sips should probably be a lot louder.
You want to slurp. You want to aerate the coffee across your tongue.
That's Coulter Sunderman, the roastmaster at H&S Coffee Roastery. On this early morning, he's leading a coffee tasting at H&S's space above an office in downtown Laramie. The event would feel similar to anyone who's been to a wine tasting. The gathered coffee fans sample six unmarked cups and toss out tasting notes.
Which kind of like a cashew or peanut butter?
This one?
That one. I thought that one was kind of nutty.
Mm-hmm. These two, yeah, very nutty.
Tasting notes are printed on each bag of coffee that H&S sells, along with the coffee bean's country of origin and often the individual farm they came from. This level of detail is pretty standard now at coffee roasteries in big cities like New York or Chicago, but it's fairly new to Wyoming.
Wyoming in general drinks a lot of coffee. They may not be specialty grade yet, but it's the first step.
That's Joshua Hyen, the other half of H&S. While Coulter Sunderman handles the roasting, Hyen is the distribution and IT guy, and that's a big part of the business. There aren't that many people to sell to in this state, so H&S has had to focus on cross-country sales through its website. But Roastmaster Sunderman says being here in Laramie has pushed them to be more creative than if they were based in a big coffee city like Denver.
Because we're rather isolated, at least in a coffee culture sense, we don't really have any external influences directing what we do. And I think that's actually really powerful.
H&S's roasting process is constant experimentation. Coffee has more flavor compounds than wine, and like a winemaker, Sunderman adjusts his roast to fit each new variety of coffee bean.
So when you roast it really meticulously, you can bring out, or rather keep intact, kind of the fingerprint that coffee has.
To get this level of precision, Sunderman tracks the progress of his roast on a computer program, which monitors and graphs things like how hot the roaster is and the moisture of the beans.
And this is where we'll see a kind of a bell curve of acidity start. The acidity will actually go up, so we want to make sure we get through that to avoid a real sour taste.
I smell coffee.
Autumn Gonzalez is one of H&S's testers. He's new to the whole specialty coffee thing, and he likes it. He says he won't be going back to his old morning routine.
What were you drinking before this?
Starbucks and gas station coffee and Folgers. I'm classic.
Joshua Hyen and Coulter Sunderman are counting on conversions like this for H&S to be a success. And so far, it seems to be working. The roastery is already selling about 700 pounds of coffee each month. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Miles Bryan.
Okay, maybe you're listening to this podcast past your daily caffeine cutoff time, so maybe it's time for a cocktail instead. What started out as a casual conversation turned into a new business for the Pollock family in Casper, Wyoming. They told Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck that it wasn't long until mom, dad, son, and daughter had all left their day jobs to start the Backwards Distilling Company.
My son's an absinthe drinker, and absinthe is hard to come by, and he and she were talking and said,
why don't we just make some?
And then we looked at each other. Yeah, we all did. We stopped and went.
That family conversation, as described by Bill, Kathy, and Amber Pollock, led to the three of them and son Chad to build and start the Backwoods Distilling Company, where they plan on developing their own brand of vodka, rum, moonshine, and more. Chad Pollock is the chief mixer and is in charge of making the spirits.
This is a vodka that we're working on, so it's 100% wheat. We're using a red wheat in our vodka.
And Chad is standing right now, near a massive copper and steel distillery in a structure that the family built in Mills. The family has invested its own money into the operation, and the four of them are the only employees. Amber and Kathy were teachers, Bill was a part owner of another business, and Chad was in school. Mother Kathy says dropping everything to do this together might sound crazy, but there was some thinking behind it. Part of it was to help her two children.
We were kind of looking for something that we could do as a family business. So I started thinking that maybe, you know, the future's a little shaky, and so we wanted to do something that maybe they would have more control of their future. So we were kind of looking and trying to come up with an idea that we thought we'd all be happy with.
After the earlier conversation between Kathy and Chad and the knowledge of the success others had with craft beer, they decided to make their own alcohol.
Now, whether it's a good idea, I don't know, but so far it's been fun.
As the chief distiller, Chad Pollock has traveled the country to get a feel for the business and to learn the trade. And he thinks the family is on the cusp of something great.
When we started this, there was only about 200 distilleries in the United States, and that was up by like double from the year before. And now there's almost 400 within just a little bit of time. So it's exploding.
He believes it'll be like the craft beer industry, although he anticipates it'll be challenging getting Wyoming people as excited about spirits as they are beer. That's where Sister Amber comes in. She has plans for an extensive marketing campaign, which includes opening up their distillery to the public.
Tastings, we'll have tours, we'll have an area downstairs where people can come and order drinks, try our stuff out.
The family has been at this for almost 2 years. Father Bill says they are anxious to finally hit on the right recipe and finally make some money. But they're being deliberate. They all know that other non-beer ventures in the state have been met with mixed reviews. He doesn't want that happening to them. That's why they will use independent testers and other distillers to check their quality.
We have done some testing, and we have unfortunately dumped some things down the drain that could have been dollar bills, but I think it's probably the smartest thing that we will have done, because when we get that product out, it's going to be worth having out there.
Chief Distiller Chad knows the rest of the family is counting on him to deliver.
You know, there is a lot of pressure. I feel pretty confident. I've learned a lot, and what I've made so far I think is promising. I've got some work to still do, but a lot of it's just growing pains into this new equipment.
The entire family says this will be a success if they can at least provide an excellent product to Casper and be able to give back to the community. But Amber also says it will be a success if they are not all broke and her parents are not living with her in a basement. The family wants to get their first batch to liquor stores this fall. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
That story originally ran in 2014. You can now find Backwoods Distilling Company's products in stores across Wyoming. Now let's hear about the rise of a product that's less popular in the U.S., goat meat. Despite the fact that it's the world's most commonly eaten meat, Americans are still squeamish about adding goat to the menu. But Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards was up for trying something new.
With goats flocking all around him for ear scratches, you could say Terry Hayes is a happy rancher. He's the owner of the largest goat ranch in Wyoming, Open A Lazy S, outside Riverton. And he says in the last few years, his business has tripled.
It's unbelievable to me how fast and how the market has changed. You know, we primarily always raised dairy goats. And then this last 5 years, we went into these boar goats. And the boar goats have just superseded my dairy goats.
By boar goats, he means meat goats. He says he's selling more to 4-H kids than ever before, and to hobby farmers.
You know, everybody's going back to the older times. Everybody's starting to raise a garden again. Canning's becoming popular again.
One of those 4-H'ers is 15-year-old Cannon Stuckert. She raises goats and chickens right in town in her Laramie backyard.
I was the first one in my 4-H club to start raising goats, and then there's like three more like in the past few years that have joined. You just see at fair the barn is more full.
But rancher Hayes says when it comes to selling bulk goat meat on the market, there's not many outlets in Wyoming. He mostly sells it in areas of the country where goat tacos are common on Tex-Mex menus.
Primarily, my large amount of goats go down to Colorado through the butcher places down there, and then they ship them on the rail either down towards Texas and stuff. There's just not as many people that are as cultured on eating it up here.
Not even in what many consider Wyoming's most cultured corner, Jackson. Kevin Humphreys is the executive chef at Spur Restaurant and Bar at Teton Mountain Resort, which specializes in foods made from locally grown ingredients. His menu's full of quirky flavors, including goat cheese. But as for putting goat meat on his menu...
You know, I've contemplated it, but, you know, I just think that it might be a hard sell.
He says he thinks eventually, like bison, goat meat will be embraced by what he calls savvy eaters. It's already making an appearance on many menus in Brooklyn and other large cities. Personally, Humphreys is a fan.
You know, it's actually a little bit sweeter than beef as well, from a flavor profile of it.
Gail Shive is a home cook experimenting with a recipe inspired by a curried casserole called bobodi that a friend from Zimbabwe made her.
Peanut oil, lamb or goat, 2 cups of water, onions, apples, banana, bay leaf.
Shive isn't one to stick to recipes. She chops up crab apples from her tree and tosses them in the curry too. But she is picky about how to sauté goat meat. She says you have to do it delicately, like you would chicken breast. That's because it's 98% lean.
I wanted to get the goat meat seared before I put the spices in. It locks the juices inside the meat to get it sealed on the outside, and so it'll maybe be a little tender.
She's experimenting with the recipe in hopes of serving it next to the turkey for Thanksgiving as another meat option. Normally, the recipe calls for lamb, but for the last couple years, Shive has been substituting goat in all her recipes.
But when I noticed it, I thought, well, it's cheaper than lamb, maybe I'll try it. And I didn't think Peter would like it necessarily, or like the idea of it, so I didn't tell him right off. I just cooked it, and he didn't say anything, and I couldn't tell the difference myself.
And neither could Peter, her husband, who grew up loving lamb. There's a bit of a marital dispute over when he officially found out he was eating goat.
Month ago? 2 months ago? That I found out?
How would I know?
Because
well, we never talked about it.
Gail, what's this goat stuff?
I don't think it is.
We sprinkle coconut flakes, fresh parsley, and Gail's orange marmalade sweet and sour sauce on the curry and sit down to eat. My first taste of goat meat?
Very tender.
Yeah.
And the musky flavor goes great with the curry's fruitiness. I can say I'll definitely try the recipe at home. I just won't tell the kids it's goat. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Chef Eric Bartle and his girlfriend Sarah Condelius have a love of bringing local ingredients into the kitchen, but it isn't always an easy thing to do. When the couple first moved from Portland to the Turpin Meadow Ranch in northwest Wyoming's Bridger-Teton Wilderness, they came face to face with blowing snow and icy roads, but they had a wedding to cater the next day. They talk about that first adventure in cooking in one of the most remote places in the lower 48, and the struggles they sometimes face as a result of being so far from the next town.
Eric's truck was overheating, so I have a Subaru Impreza. And we were moving to Wyoming, so I put,
In February.
So I bought new tires. for the car.
But and we were stuck in a blizzard in Portland, Oregon. Yeah, yes, they do have blizzards in Portland, Oregon once a decade, and it happened to be
the weekend we were leaving.
The weekend we were leaving.
And
so.
And Portland doesn't have the infrastructure for snow melting and removal, so we got trapped in Oregon, and then we had a small window, and then we got here. We packed up the car real quick because the major highway that we needed to take opened because it was icy. And we, the priority was Eric's kitchen stuff in the car. And it was like, can I bring my pickling Crocs? And I'm like, no, because I need to bring like shirts. So we,
it was only 3 milk crates of cookbooks.
Exactly.
In the Subaru.
So we really came out with, you know, like wool socks and pants and gloves and jackets and pickles and cookbooks and knives. So that's pretty much what fit in the car, and boots. So we made it here, and we were supposed to be catering a wedding the next night, and our shopping wasn't done. So the day of the wedding, we do our shopping, but then they closed the road because of a blizzard. They closed it at Moose, so we couldn't actually get from Jackson up the Buffalo Valley Road. But then we could, by some miracle, like, oh, get behind the snowplow for the school buses. So
at 1:30 in the afternoon. And
while we were cooking at 12:50. So we did. We loaded hot food and cold food, and we got on the convoy. We got out up here. You couldn't see anything. I mean, it was so blizzardy, and the snow was at least 4 feet deep. And then we did pull off the wedding. It was fine. It was great, actually. It was like, what, 5 courses, and we had all these wild mushrooms that we brought and for soup. And I mean, so it was really a mix of Wyoming and Oregon at that point. But then it didn't stop snowing for like a month.
Yeah.
And I mean, for those first 10 days, it was like a foot of snow a night. I mean, there was one weekend where we had 4 groomers on the cross-country trails, and they just kept doing circles all day long from Friday to Monday because there was just so much snow. And then it can take out your phone line. It takes your power. And because we're on a well, and I grew up on a well, so as soon as the power goes out, I just start filling things with fresh water because you don't have a pump anymore. And so it gets real interesting real quick, especially when you don't have the internet, but that doesn't matter because your computer would be off. But when you don't have water and you don't have a phone, all of a sudden you really realize where you're at. Like, oh, like if it's a blizzard and that went out, like, are the roads open? Like, what if I need stitches or something? It's like, you know, so I'm just like, don't slip on the ice or anything. Or like, you know, when I'm chopping kindling, I'm like, okay, stand back and really concentrate on every single cut because you never know what's gonna stay. And I mean, and maybe I think it's part of the romance for us to be out here. Like, okay, how much can we get done with nothing? And less, not convenience, but less dependence, I think. And I think that's one of the reasons why we came out here is to experience that and, you know.
Yeah, it's a challenge. You get through it and you feel a little bit better about yourself at the end of the night, and you realize the power's still on, and so, or stuff power's still off, and here we go again. But,
well, and I think that too, like, balanced with like this beautiful, beautiful lodge and those beautiful cabins and this beautiful setting, like, we get the best of both worlds. Like, we get the super high end. Like, yeah, I did make these cherries for your old fashioned, so it's extra, extra delicious while you're looking at the mountains. And you have fantastic wool blankets and down blankets. But also, like, when the power goes out, like, well, I have a headlamp and the gas still works.
10 cords of wood.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that it's kind of the best of both worlds at that point as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and having lived out here in Wyoming for 7 years and then in Montana for a couple, I have a little bit of experience as far as knowing that, yeah, it might not stop snowing out here for a while. And so you kind of have to prepare for everything and anything. I mean, when we had the snowmobile tour and the guy comes running into the lodge and demands a chainsaw from you. And
I haven't even been into the barn.
Yeah. Yeah, and so...
I'm like, wait, who are you, first of all? I'm not just giving away chainsaws.
But that's what we have to deal with out here is you never know what's going to happen at the end of this road. And it's amazing how 46 miles can separate you from 46, 44, whatever we are. This point doesn't matter. We're a long ways from a head of garlic. It makes it a challenge. And I think, I kind of enjoy it a little bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it switches things up.
Do you think you'll ever ask me to marry you? It was the perfect time. It was hilarious. I can't not ask that, right? Say it.
Yep. Just trying to figure out how do I place the ring? Do I put it in a morel mushroom as you sneak around? Because it's going to be something out in the woods. I mean,
don't put it in a chicken's mouth.
Yeah, it won't
I'll have to wait for it.
It won't be in a slice of cheesecake at a restaurant.
Or a champagne flute.
Yeah, I mean, and you've already given me the list of rings that think you'd be interested in, or the ring makers. So, yeah, I got to keep you surprised.
I like to be prepared.
Yeah. But I just can't figure out how to put a ring inside of a razor clam so that when you pull it out of the sand, you get that said razor clam. Still trying to figure that one out, but when I pull it off, it's going to be the best proposal ever.
Yay. That'll be great. Well, on that note, I love you very much, and I'm glad we're here.
I love you very much, and yeah.
Eric Bartle and Sarah Candelius recorded that conversation as part of Wyoming Stories. The piece was produced by Rebecca Huntington. So, of course, gourmet eats and drinks are very nice, but plain old water is the basis of everything that touches our taste buds. Water conservation and distribution has been a problem in the Mountain West for ages. It causes problems for those who don't have enough and for those who have too much. Local wildlife has been struggling too. An agreement between ranchers and the Upper Colorado River Commission could help ease the strain. Melody Edwards has that story.
Rancher Eric Barnes and his family live on Fontenelle Creek near Kemmer in southwest Wyoming. It's a ranch his father built in the 1950s.
It's a really beautiful place because it's kind of in the foothills of the desert.
And it backs onto the mountains where the creek flows down to join the Green River in Fontenelle Reservoir. While droughts have devastated crops in the southwest over the last few years, Barnes was having the opposite problem.
I had been needing to rebuild all my diversions because they've been blowed out just from high water in the last few years. And I didn't know how I was going to afford to do all these projects because all the diversions needed worked on.
His flood-damaged irrigation gates were expensive to replace. So he turned to Trout Unlimited, who helped him turn his surplus water into a moneymaker. They helped him apply for a new multi-state pilot program through the Upper Colorado River Commission that pays water rights holders like Barnes not to irrigate. Wyoming Trout Unlimited director Corey Toy says while more flow in the stream will help droughts downstream, it'll also help Wyoming's wildlife that suffered from a 15-year drought.
In Wyoming, agriculture and cold water fisheries overlay each other extensively, and in fact, some of our most important fisheries are on private land.
And Toy says, sure, Wyoming hasn't been hit by drought as hard as lower states, but it has still hurt some fish populations.
There are tributaries where we've seen extended low flows over the last couple of years.
Those low flows are threatening the extinction of several native fish species downstream. But Toy says high mountain ranchers are in a great position to help conserve the Colorado River for such species. He says after they've cut their hay, ranchers have water to spare.
These landowners that participated were able to increase the value of their private water right last season. There was a value associated with leaving it in the stream that the Upper Colorado River Commission compensated them for.
And compensated them well. Rancher Eric Barnes wouldn't say exactly how much he was paid not to irrigate, but the two-year program was funded at $2.7 million to go to a few lucky ranchers in the four Upper Basin states. Barnes was one of only five in Wyoming. Colorado River Conservation Director Steve Wolf at the Wyoming State Engineer's Office says it's not a new concept.
This type of program, system conservation fallowing, has been ongoing in Lower Basin for a long time. They do it basically every year. They're very efficient at it. We've never really tried it in the Upper Basin.
But river ecologist Ellen Wohl at Colorado State University says paying ranchers for their water won't protect the river's ecology forever.
I think it's a great idea to pay farmers not to use as much water or not to farm marginal lands. It's just a little bit vulnerable to economic fluctuations.
Like when the price of beef goes up and ranchers are less motivated to sell their water. She says the bigger threat to water conservation comes from states themselves. Governor Matt Mead plans to stockpile Wyoming's share of water by building 10 new water storage projects in the next 10 years. And the state of Colorado means to build more dams, too. That approach seems schizophrenic to ecologist Wohl.
If you view the Colorado River as an ecosystem, that ecosystem has to have a certain amount of water if it's going to persist. So you can't take all the water in the upper basin and basically have nothing getting to the lower basin.
Wohl votes for removing dams, not building more, since they block the movement of wildlife and sediment. She says it's time to let the Colorado return to its former shape, with more floodplains, pools, and curves. Rancher Eric Barnes says many of his neighbors consider this crazy talk.
A lot of people are skeptical because it's dealing with your water right. And you can't blame anybody for being skeptical because water's life.
He says personally, he hopes the Upper Colorado River Commission decides to adopt the water conservation program permanently. He appreciates the fact that his hay still gets watered and he's got cash in his pocket. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
That story originally aired in January of this year. And that's it for this edition of The Modern West. You can catch our next episode on the third Tuesday of the month. If you like what you hear, we'd appreciate a positive rating on iTunes or wherever you're listening right now. In the meantime, you can find lots more stories about the Modern West at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Raina Bush produced this episode. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell, and I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.